Before I get to this episode of the Naffy Moore Right Rudder podcast, I'd like to take a moment to thank Avemco Insurance Company for their continued support of the Naffy Moore Right Rudder podcast. We appreciate them for sponsoring this episode and the several episodes previously. Their continued support means so much to us as Naffy, means so much to me as the creator of this podcast, and for all of the support that they provide Naffy and its members. We thank them. More specifically, we want to make sure that you are aware of the Naffy CFI insurance or liability insurance plan provided by Avemco Insurance Company. If you want some information about that, it is exclusive to Naffy members, and you can check it out at naffynet.org/insurance, or you can find the plan on avemco.com. So again, exclusive to Naffy members, check it out. And if you're not a member and you want to take advantage of that insurance plan, you can join us and you can get $10 off if you enter in the promo code POD49, Papa Oscar Delta 49, when you join or renew Naffy. That'll get you a little bit of a discount. And of course, it's our little thanks for listening to this podcast. So thank you, Avemco, for sponsoring another episode, and on to the program. Instructors and Naffy members, John Niehaus, Director of Program Development for the National Association of Flight Instructors, welcoming you back to another episode of the Naffy Moore Right Rudder podcast, the podcast for flight instructors on the go. And today I have a very special guest. Geeta Brown is joining me, and she just finished her first solo. She's a student pilot and finished about 2 days ago, right?
That is correct. Thank you.
So, congratulations on that. That's a monumental experience, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that shortly. Now, Geeta is a yoga and classical music instructor. She's also a writer, and she is a published columnist for the Boston Globe, and she is a regular columnist for the Integral Yoga Magazine, which is the oldest magazine on the subject matter. She comes from a family of educators. And I'll let you get into some of that, because I know that a lot of your family members have been in education in different forms for a long time. And, you know, we got to talking about kind of the different types of instruction, the different types of education, and how the seemingly unrelated topics can actually lend themselves into different ways of teaching different things. And we talked about a lot of things, and those are the different subject matter areas we're going to talk about today. But Geeta, what did I miss? Tell me a little bit more about yourself.
What did you miss? Well, I think that's a pretty good potted history of sort of what's going on in the land of Geeta. I don't know if you want me to talk about my background in flying first, or if you want to dive into like the educational perspective, because they're of course interrelated, but they're kind of two separate stories. So do you want some more backstory on why I'm this middle-aged lady who decided to fly?
Yeah, the most exciting part that's going on in your life right now is the flying, considering the first solo. Let's talk about that journey just a little bit.
Okay. So I am in my early 50s, and interestingly enough, very, 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 very long ago, my father was actually a pilot as well. He flew sailplanes out in California, and he did the mountain wave flying and distance flying, and he flew in competitions and all of that. Most of that occurred before I was like 7 years old. So I have vague memories of that. And then he had an eye injury, which grounded him. But I do remember him flying, but I never went up with him. So it's been great. He's now in his late 90s. Love you, Dad. So it's been great now to talk to him about my own journey in flying.
Yeah.
So that's been interesting to me, because it was not like an aviation family at all. He's a chemistry professor. So where I came to flying then was I actually developed a crippling fear of flying. Mm-hmm. And you would maybe be surprised or not to know that 1 in 5 people have a fear of flying. I actually think it's a lot higher than that, but that's the stats. Those are the people who admit they have a fear of flying. All you have to do is
Sure.
look on a commercial plane and you can tell the people who are terrified. They're usually staring straight ahead and not moving and not talking and hardly breathing. The fear of flying for me developed really slowly over a long period of time, but it was kept tamped down by the fact that I was still flying for, in my role as an educator for yoga and for music, would just fly frequently enough to keep it that it was, you know, at a low simmer where I could handle it. But then cue the pandemic and I did not fly. So I had no exposure therapy. And it just sort of blossomed during that time. And it got to the point where I would even look at a plane in the sky and my heart would start racing and my mouth would go dry, or someone would mention they're taking a trip somewhere and I would like start panicking for them. I would have catastrophic thinking, sleepless nights, crying for a day, you know, before a flight. I mean, just really pretty out of control anxiety over the fear of flying. And I went, well, this can't be. I'm this yoga educator who, you know, I've been meditating for 30 years. How has my mind managed to take over and attach fear onto this one thing that I know is not rational, but yet seemingly I can't control it? So that led me into a very deep dive into the world of aviation. Dun, 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 dun.
Yay.
Yay! And very potted history short, I found a wonderful community called Love Fly. So it's just like what it sounds, Love Fly. And it's a community of people that's founded by Paul Tizzard. Shout out to Paul and his crew, because he used to work for Virgin Atlantic way back when as crew, and he did all of their fear of flying courses.
Huh.
And then he sort of retired from that, stopped doing the fear of flying thing, but people kept bothering him, saying, Paul, we need you to do this thing. So after several years, he then started this company called Love Fly, which is just helping everyday people like me change their thoughts around flying so that you can have the freedom of making a choice to fly or not, rather than having a limiting belief. So he's a very has very cheeky humor. He's got a great team of people around him, and I started working with his sort of philosophy, started getting engaged with that community, and one of their big things is exposure therapy. So started
Interesting.
exposing myself to lots of aviation videos, going to Boston Logan and watching planes taking off. And just, I worked my butt off to desensitize myself with commercial aviation. Along the way, I thought, well, if I go up in one of those tiny general aviation planes, if I do that, then certainly I could get on an Airbus, you know, it'll be no problem.
Oh, yeah.
So I called a local flight school and said, hi, I have a crippling fear of flying. I'm terrified. I'm probably going to throw up all over your plane, which I have horrible motion sickness. I mean, I'm just laying it all on the line, right? Like, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be a disaster on that day, but would you be willing, you know, to take me on a discovery flight or at least just help me? And they were wonderful. Can't say enough about them. We can talk more about that if you'd like, but took the discovery flight. And after a ton of coaxing, that instructor, who is now my CFI, finally got me to put my hand on the yoke. I mean, it took a lot for me to even put my hand on the yoke. And he said, okay, your controls. I was like, my controls. And in that moment, it was like the switch flipped. And I looked out, and I remember we were flying sort of vaguely towards Boston. And I could see the ocean. I could see that sort of rugged, scrappy Boston skyline, and then the beautiful blue hills, which I realized why they're called the blue hills, because from the air they look blue. Blue hills in front of Boston, and I could see a peak of some of the mountains up in New Hampshire, and I just fell in love. It was like that fear like flipped and made me realize that there was that love that had been waiting for me all along. And that was it. And then it took me like a year and a half of work, or maybe a little bit more than that, to actually get to the point to where I could solo, because it took a lot of time to desensitize, to get myself to a point where I could actually be in that smaller airplane and learn without the fear response sort of continually taking over. And at some point, of course, with work dedication, that flipped, and I flew solo the other day with not even a qualm or a worry. So that's my sort
Amazing.
of potted aviation history, and Now here I am in my 50s going, what, how, you know, how do I fuel this new addiction?
How do I get more? I want to do
How do
more.
I get more? I need more. I told my husband, I'm like, you don't understand. This is a way of life now. If we move somewhere else, it has to be near a small general aviation airport. Like, this is just who I am now. So that's how I come to be here today.
So let's dig into a couple things here. One of the questions I had, and you said exposure therapy was one of the techniques that the Love Fly gentleman put together, but what were some of the other techniques that helped you?
So a big one, so exposure therapy was absolutely huge. Videos on YouTube, you know, up and close and personal desensitization like that. A big one, which has actually served me really well in music, in some extent to yoga, but definitely in music and now in flight training, is visualization. The in music, quite often, it, say you have to play, like I've played the Mozart clarinet concerto. It's a long piece, right? It takes 20 or more minutes to get through. There might be a day where I don't have the physicality in my hands or my fingers to practice more on that day, but I know I need to do a run through of the concerto. So I would sit down in very intense, vivid detail, imagine that I'm not only playing the concerto, but I'm walking into the room, I'm assembling my instrument, I'm warming up. Like, do a practice as if I'm actually doing it so vividly that I can actually feel my fingertips sweating and I can feel my tongue muscles sort of responding to the imagery. Because when I visualize like that as a musician, it lights up the same areas in the motor cortex as if I were actually doing the movements themselves. But you have to not just sort of imagine or think about it, you have to intensely conjure that image as if you were actually doing it. It takes a lot of concentration. So I'm used to doing that for music, of this very intense mental rehearsal and practice. I mean, Olympians do it. It's a well-known and documented practice. So I would do that for aviation as well. I would see myself walking down the I want to call it the tunnel, but you know, to get onto the actual airplane, that's a point of conflict for a lot of fearful flyers and where a lot of them leave and don't make it onto the aircraft. So I'd visualize myself walking down that passageway, sitting in my seat, smelling the jet fuel and the smells of the people around me, especially after COVID, you know, being in a small space with lots of people, that sort of was a little bit of a like, oh, is this safe now kind of feeling. Had to get over that one. So that really intense visualization was key. By the time that I got onto some flights, like to go to Chicago and Denver, I was like, oh, I've been here before. I've done this already. To my brain, it was like, you've rehearsed this, you've done this before. So visualization was a key one. And then overall, just getting a grip as a yogi, right? Like, yogi, heal thyself. Like, dial up my yoga practice, which for me is meditation, breathing, and the physical practices of yoga, as well as reading some of the ancient scriptures and philosophy books, which say all the same stuff. Because guess what? For thousands of years, human beings have been stressed out. And the same techniques of like, spend some time in nature, take care of your health, drink some water, you know, think good thoughts, surround yourself with good people. That same advice has been happening for thousands of years. So sometimes reading those books would just remind me. Do the simple things very well and decrease my overall level of stress and anxiety. So that if I had a little spike, it's just a little spike. It wasn't like I was already at this elevated, high wire state of tension. So visualization, massive self-care, yoga, 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 getting a grip of my own mind. Yeah.
And we're going to dig into that too. But I'm actually really glad you said that about, the ancient scriptures, because we like to think as a society that we're unique. We like to think that, oh, we're more stressed out now than we've ever been before, and I've got so many problems and all of these things. And like you said, we might have different problems, but at least we don't have to like go out and find our own food or
Correct.
Where am I sleeping today? At least hopefully for the majority of us, that's not a problem. But it's interesting to remind yourself that we, for as many unique problems as we think we have, history would show that those things are continuously there.
Yeah, and the human response to stress is the same. That's why the practices of things like yoga, I also practice Qigong. Which is, for listeners who aren't familiar with that, it's a Taoist longevity practice that works on both sort of that internal self and the external self. Similar to Tai Chi would be a very close correlate. And what I find so interesting though is the human response to stress has been always been the same. We have functionally the same nervous system, right? We go into the fight, flight, freeze moments. That hasn't changed, regardless if the stressor is you're overwhelming yourself by continually checking the news all day long, or whether you have food stress, like you said, or you have, stress over shelter or physical safety. The autonomic nervous system responds in the same way. So the techniques to counter that, breathing slowly and deeply, spending time in nature, stillness, positive and uplifting environments, does the same thing because your body doesn't know that it's living in 2024 or if it's back in 1950 or 1600 or thousands of years before that. Still the same animal body that we've always had.
And that's really interesting to hear because, this is one of those things for those instructors in the crowd. We have to read the fundamentals of instruction, the FOI, and the FOI covers Maslow's hierarchy of needs and all of these other things that we need to look for in the students. And sometimes we get good at seeing that in the students. We don't always get good at seeing it in ourselves. So it's kind of that sort of different sides of the same coin. The other thing that you said that I thought was interesting was sort of the visualization that you mentioned. In aviation we call it chair flying, right? But I think the technique that you mentioned that would be good to sort of bring into what we do is we kind of look at it from the sense of here's how I run a checklist or here's how I do the profile of a maneuver. Not always are we briefing some of those before things, like you mentioned, walking out to the airplane. What am I looking for? What am I doing? Why am I doing what I'm doing? And that can even encompass the pre-flight walk around. It can encompass how do I prepare myself for a maneuver that maybe I'm scared of. With our initial communication, we talked about students that might be afraid of stalls or something like that. Well, how do you approach that with somebody? So both from the instructor side, but also from the student side, if there are things that we know are going to be stressors, how do we approach that? Or how do we recommend that the student approach that in a way that maybe allows them to find some calm in the maneuver, knowing that they're going to have to do it, but we're going to do it in a way that's safe and is a sort of welcomingly calm environment for them.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating what you're talking about. And now that I've been training for so long, much longer than most people do pre-solo, or I guess now post-solo. Oh, finally get to say
Yay.
that. That I feel like I've sort of seen a lot of the training environment. And one thing that sort of strikes me about what you're saying is that I have had many people tell me, armchair fly, armchair fly, but that's all they say. Well, what does that actually mean? Now I take from it, I was like, oh, that's like visualization. I already know because I've already been trained in that visualization. But if it doesn't, for me, if the armchair flying doesn't, if it only involves, let me back up. If the armchair flying only involves, as you said, the checklist and the very cerebral step by step, let me just sort of knock these things off one by one, then it's missing the whole being that we bring on to into the cockpit. Right, we
The
bring
emotional
all of
connection.
our sense, well, the emotional connection, but also all of our senses. And it also really negates the fact that our bodies actually work sort of as this is reductionist, but as a two-way communication. Like we tend to think of our mind as like this, it's the boss, right? Our cerebral cortex is the boss of everything. And if I say I want to go walk across that room and water that plant, my mind says, do that thing, and my body just responds, right? Like I have this illusion that my cerebral cortex is always in command and control. However, the body has sort of what they call in yoga traditions, a wisdom of its own, but it has responses of its own to its environment. Case in point, if you bite into a lemon, automatically you get a rush of saliva. You can't think your way out of getting that rush of saliva. It happens. Put your hand on a hot stove, you're going to pull it back. Even if you've really trained yourself to not pull back, it's going to be very hard to override that body's autonomic response. So for me, when I'm flying, and I think I was so heightened in the beginning, every sense was like, what's that? What's that? My CFI was like, you can't bank more than 10 degrees. Little mosquito's gonna freak out. But all of that sensory input was so visceral and alive to me that once I got through the fear response, I was like, I can actually use this to my advantage. At least the flying I do, VFR, general aviation. All of that sensory input is actually part of the experience for me of flying an aircraft. It's not just that my brain is going to boss and make this situation turn out the way I want it to. I actually need the cerebral cortex to do what it does, run the checklist, run the flows, be attentive, but I also need to be paying attention to those subtle cues from my body and the parts of my brain that work much faster than my cerebral cortex can classify that information. So that I can make use of those little, what we call intuition or gut instinct, which is actually just your brain process working faster than your thinking brain can catch up to. Pay attention to all of that, because I think for me, that's what's making me already feel like a relatively safe and competent pilot, because I'm not just feeling like I have to somehow, yes, I do have to be in control, but I'm working with the environment rather than imposing myself on the environment. That was very long-winded to say, sort of,
I
use
think it's
all of your
great.
senses when you're flying.
I really appreciate your perspective, and it's really nice to hear it from a student, because so often these conversations are crossed between two instructors who don't necessarily remember what it's like to be a student.
Right.
And you sort of answered this question already, but I'm going to come at it from a different way. When we talk about fear, we talk about the fear of flying or a fear of maneuvers. Obviously you found ways of overcoming that. And I'll ask it to you sort of in two different ways. The first being, did you find that the fear became a motivator for you, or was it something you just sort of had to kind of put in a box and sort of throw behind you? And
Oh.
then the second piece to that is, your instructor. Were they an active participant in, helping you overcome this fear, or did you find that that was something that you kind of had to do on your own? And if so, did the instructor have techniques that worked for you?
How much time do you have? Okay. So the first thing about fear being a motivator or fear being something that I had to put in a box and throw away. Actually, the way I look at it, is actually I made fear my best friend.
Okay.
A friend befriended it.
Option C.
Option C, exactly. Choose your own adventure. Do you remember those books? Maybe I'm
Yes, I
dating
do.
myself. Okay. Yeah, option C, made it my own best friend. Carl Jung, that psychoanalyst, has this great quote. I'm going to butcher it. Sorry, Jung, but it's something like, if you don't take what is unconscious and make it conscious, it will forever boss you around and you will call it fate. Something to that effect, right? Which is all those unconscious beliefs, those limiting beliefs we have, the insecurities we have, imposter syndrome, feeling not good enough, being worried that you won't measure up, my peers won't approve of me, on and on and on. If we actually, for me, don't take that out into the open and acknowledge it and hear what it's trying to tell me and learn from that wisdom, it will continue to motivate me, even if I think that I've quote unquote conquered my fear. Or gotten over it. Because once again, that's my ego or my cerebral cortex thinking, ha ha, I figured out this game of life. I've got it. I'm in control. Only until the next thing comes along, which hits you in the face as life does. And
Right.
then back to square one again. Why do I feel the same way again? I thought I got over this. So a big part for me of that fear was doing something that my yoga teachers have trained me to do. And this particularly goes to Sonia Sumar, the founder of what was called Yoga for the Special Child, and it's now Yoga for All Abilities, because she really teaches people through all ages and abilities. So I teach people who have autism, who've been through brain cancer, end stage life, all breast cancer. I teach typical high school kids who have plenty of stress. Oh my gosh, those kids. But Sonia taught me this technique. She said, sit down in meditation. Do your chanting and your breathing just to quiet your mind. She said, and then take your fear and put it in a chair in front of you and have a conversation with it. Why are you here? What are you asking me to see? What is it inside of me that I'm trying to resolve? Is it some childhood thing that happened that I've been carrying around and just never even realized it? Is it some limiting belief you have about your life? She said, talk to it. Actually listen to it. See what it's trying. It's getting your attention for a reason. It's trying to tell you something. And have a conversation with it. And when you feel like you know what to do with it, then ask for it. For me, it was asking my fear, hey, look at what you're doing to me. It's not helpful. I know you're trying to protect me, but wow, you're actually creating the very conditions you're trying to avoid, which is me being out of control, me not feeling like I have agency in my life, me feeling like I don't have power. You're actually creating that, right? So, not helping. So come along with me. And I told my fear in meditation here, opening the vault, here we go. I said, look, I need you because at times you might alert me to something in my environment that actually is dangerous, or you might alert me to a thought pattern I'm having that's really unhelpful, that's going to lead me to, making some bad decisions. In those moments, you have my permission to raise the red flag. And on my part, I will use my mind to be alert to those moments and make sure I check in and see if they're accurate information. Other than that, I'm going to ask you just to sit in the passenger seat and remain silent. You're here with me, right? But I'm going to be guiding things, but I promise I will listen to you when I need to. And that really helped. But I have been meditating now for 30 plus years every morning. So I have a very good relationship with my mind. And I've been trained extensively, by swamis and gurus and that type of thing to really, sit with myself. So I'm going to get to the next one you asked, which is about the instructor, because I have a lot to say about how fabulous he is. But this is something we touched on in our pre-conversation. Instructors out there, I can tell you as someone who puts their hands on children with special needs who are nonverbal, if I come to them and I do not trust myself, if I do not trust the method, if I don't trust the child, and if I am not centered and calm, that child can feel it and they will start crying before I have even begun the session. I see it over and over and over again. People say, how do you get a child with autism to calm down and do yoga? How do you get them to do yoga? And the answer is, I don't get them to do yoga. I embody it to the best of my ability, and I bring that energy and mindset into the space. And just by how I am, they start to learn what yoga is, which is being connected to yourself. So if we as instructors of anything, and this goes for me as a musician too, if I go into a music student and I'm like a little insecure that maybe I haven't been practicing much lately and my read isn't very good, and they ask me to demonstrate something, and I'm like, oh my gosh, can I even play that passage? What if I biff it? What are they going to think about me? They're going to think I'm not very good. They're not going to want to take lessons with me anymore. If I spiral like that in my mind, even if I'm pretending like I've got it and I play the Copeland or whatever, they're going to feel and pick up subtly on that insecurity, and it erodes that trust between teacher and student. Sometimes you don't even know these things are happening, but they really are. So, as instructors, if we're not really, I think for me, doing our own work on knowing ourselves well and being honest about our limitations and our unconscious motivations, it can really get in the way of building a relationship where you're helping the student then to get to know themselves better.
And sometimes showing that you can make a mistake, that you can botch a maneuver, you can botch a piece of music actually endears you to the student. I mean, I had that all the time where it was like, man, I don't, oof, I haven't done a lazy eight or a steep spiral in a long time. Let's see how this goes. And sometimes it went okay, and sometimes it's like, all right, well, why don't you tell me what I did wrong? Because we both know that I screwed this up. And the FOI, again, kind of that's the main governing book on how you interact with a student and how you teach for us as instructors. The first thing it'll tell you, sort of rule number one, is don't, if you get it wrong, don't make it up. You know, admit it. If you're sitting on the ground and a student asks you a question about, okay, well, What does this mean? And you kind of sit in your head going, gosh, I really should know that, but I think it's this. Well, now you've done two things. A, you've made something up, which inherently creates a little bit of distrust, whether the student admits it or not. And then the second piece to it is, of course, the whole primacy thing. If you've told them something that you kind of knew was wrong, and now you're going to spend the next, week and a half trying to fight against having told them something incorrect knowingly. And so there's this kind of battle of not just the retention in the mind, but then the trust in the mind too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fantastic when students, the best teachers that I've had have been teachers who figure it out with me. And I'll talk about my flight instructor in a moment, but I have to give a dad story. Can I give a dad
Yeah, go
story?
for it.
Dad. So my father is a organic chemistry professor. He
So
was a
super smart.
professor. Yeah, I think so. My mom is also an organic chemist. She's actually considered sort of like, I guess now the grandmother, that she's older, that sort of the grandmother of pharmaceutical drug design.
My
So she
goodness.
was responsible for sort of doing some of the early stereoscopic imaging of drugs, and particularly like how to target a compound so it could actually get into a cell and produce the therapeutic effect. I mean, she's a super smarty pants.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the dinner conversations when Gita was six. So, but what I remember from my dad is less of the flying and more of being in his office in the chemistry department. And he would just like hand me chalk, this was back when we had chalkboards, and be like, draw on the board is yours, have fun, whatever. I have to tutor the student. And this was usually in the summer when he had research students. So these were his advanced students, and really that mentor mentee relationship, or what I would call master and apprentice relationship, like we have in yoga, where it's over a long period of time. And no matter what you do, you always return to the feet of this teacher. You're just always there learning from them. It's not just to get a rating or get a certificate. You're just, teach me everything. I'm here. I'm humble. So we had those types of students in these sessions. I'd be over there copying his little diagrams of like water molecules on the board. And I'd listen to him teach, and the student would come in, they were doing their research, then they'd come bring him the research and say, "Professor, I'm stuck," or something. So they would come in, usually frustrated, usually anxious, shoulders hunched, breathing fast, clutching their little papers, and they'd be like, "Professor Martin, I just, this, I don't remember chemistry, 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 is what they said. This happened, this happened, this happened. I don't know what to do next. I don't know which sequence to run next. What should I do?" And he would pause. This was the greatest lesson. He would pause and kind of go, He'd lean back in his chair and he would just look at what they brought in. And he would always fold his hands and kind of put them over his belly. And he'd be like, "Well, I'm not really sure. What do you think we should do next?" And there was just this quietness in the room that he would create. First, there was that pause of inviting them to stop the mental spin, right? A pause. And then there was the admission of, "I don't know what to do next. I'm not just going to tell you an answer. I don't know either." And then ball back in their court, right? You still have the controls. What do you think we should do? And they would, just that moment of pause and him admitting, "I don't know either," would like give them like, "Oh, this is supposed to be a spirit of inquiry, not a spirit of get the right answer, otherwise you're doomed and you're a failure." It was like, right, he was doing all of that in just that simple space, time, admitting he doesn't have the answer, and sort of like, "What do you think? Like, let's have a discussion about it." And I think that, like, I call him like my first guru, my first teacher, right? He like was learning from that education is less about, at a certain point, people know how to fly the plane or play the clarinet or teach a yoga pose or a meditation technique, but it's more about, can you create the conditions so that the student can figure it out for themselves, and that you're sort of like an active partner in that. So, Dad, you rock. You know that. I tell you that all the time, but maybe he'll listen to
Love it.
this. So, you asked about my CFI.
Yeah, so how did they become an active participant in overcoming your fears? Or was that more of a personal struggle that you tried to conquer on your own? Like, What was the dynamic relationship with that?
So my CFI is NAFI board member George Allen.
Shout out to George.
Shout out to George, thank you. So I'd say the very first thing that he did was picked up the phone when I called. Who answers the phone anymore? But it happened. And when I did that initial sort of spew of like all my fear and insecurity, I'm just going to lay it on the line because I wanted to see how this person would respond if he had just said something like, "Oh, you'll be fine, we'll go up." That would have been an instant, "I'll go on to the next person on the list" thing, right? That minimization of the fear does not help because the person knows they'll be fine. They know it's okay. They know it's relatively safe. That's not the issue. They don't need it to be brushed off. They actually need it to be an active partner. So he was like, yeah. So the very first thing he did was actually, I went to the airport and I spent over an hour just in his office, just talking to him. Like, that was it. There was no like pressure to go out to the airplane. It was just two people in a room having a conversation. So I was like, oh, this is someone who understands that I'm not just gonna like rush out there and want to get my hands on the controls and take off in 20 minutes. Like I'm sure some people are so excited to do, but that wasn't me. So he took his time with me. And even on the Discovery flight itself, I was extremely hesitant to even put my hand on the yoke. I mean, it was like I literally looked at him and said, I don't think I can do it. Just and he said, how about this? I still have the controls. Just put your hand on the yoke, but I'm still flying. Like he would always take the next step. Like if there was a step that would freak me out, he would find the step below it and just let me sit there for a little while until I went like, oh, this step's okay, that's cool. And then he'd say, okay, now you can do that thing. Instead of that constant pushing and driving, which is very prevalent in our society, push, drive, right? We have that very much 110% go through, which works to a certain extent, but usually breaks people down over the long haul. He would always just sort of back off to what I could do, let me hang out there, and then when I was ready, nudge me forward. And I was just very upfront with him, and I said, it's going to take me a lot of flights that are just desensitization flights. And he was totally okay with that. And he would make them as much of a learning opportunity as we possibly could. So I think when you're so fearful, there's only, I mean, it was probably a good, let me think of the timeline. It was probably a good 9 months of flights where the fear was so prevalent that I wasn't learning effectively. It was really only like this past October that something finally clicked and I felt like, oh yeah, I'm just going to flight school. It's just a thing. Like it wasn't, okay, 80% of me is in the plane freaking out that I'm in a plane, and 20% of me is like, this is so freaking cool. I love it. It took a long time for that ratio to change. So I'd say that that was the biggest thing is that he somehow instinctively knew probably he's just an awesome, generally incredible person and knew always when to dial it back and when to push. You'd have to ask him about that. So I'm sure there were many days when he was pulling his hair out. In terms of the other elements of fear, I think he also fed me as much information as possible. I'm a pretty insatiable learner, so if there was a book or a podcast or a video, he would just constantly send me things to read and to just soak in aviation in general. You know, books about the Wright brothers, on and on and on. That was also extremely helpful. And I think just overall, like the general from the beginning, him and Deb Allen as well. Shout out to Deb, who runs the flight school. Without her, there'd be no schedule, there'd be no planes, there'd be nothing.
That's George's mom, right?
Correct,
Yeah,
correct.
I've met her once. She's very nice.
Yeah, and also his dad and also Adam, the other flight instructor. They always just seem to have this attitude like, well, of course you're going to become a pilot. And they're like, and yeah, you're going to be a CFI someday. So don't worry. Like, they were, just, it was like a given to them. Like, you're going to do that thing. And I was like, have you seen me out there? I'm a mess. I'm a da, 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 da. And they'd just be like, they would just not even fuel it at all. They're just going to be like, yeah, so you're going to do this thing and it's going to be awesome. Like, it was just very matter of fact. And sometimes just having another person look at you and just not buy into your internal drama is very helpful. You know, but to actually see your potential was huge. Yeah, so I think patience and time. What's the other things he did? Where there were days where I would show up, like I had a dog for 12 years. The dog died. I was in immense grief, but I had a flight lesson like 2 days later. I came in, I was like, I am not okay to fly today. I'm distracted. I backed into a parking spot out there and I thought I was between the lines, and then I looked and I was not. So I don't think I'm as clear as I think I am, and I think it's because my dog passed away very suddenly and unexpected. But I'm here and I really want to fly. So he had that ability to be like, hey, I need to do a cross country to get this thing up to the hours. Why don't we just go do a fun flight? You can actually be a passenger for once, and we can go fly to this little island, have some lunch, and come back. I'm like, awesome. Like taking a fun flight, right? But at the right time, like reminding me while I was doing this, but also letting me see it in context. I could probably write a book about everything that George has done to help me. You
That's
should
good.
get
And
on the
you know, it's funny. You mentioned how they said, "Oh, well, you're gonna eventually become a CFI," and frankly, I hope that you do.
Thank
I
you.
have found through observation, but also my own experiences, that anyone can become a good CFI, but I have also found that those that have struggles, those that, had a fear issue or had a lack of understanding of certain things or struggled just in general in flight training, like it wasn't easy for me. I had friends that they grew up in the industry. One of my best friends, his dad was chief pilot of Domino's, so this kid was
Wow.
destined to just breeze through everything. So
Yeah.
here I am, repeating lesson three, four times, and he's already on, lesson 23, almost a check ride, and I'm going, well, what's wrong with me?
Yeah. I can
Now,
relate
granted, he's a
to that.
special case because he was a fantastic CFI, but I have found that some that kind of breeze through it, they don't understand. They don't know what it's like for somebody to not, comprehend a certain thing. Or I had a couple instructors where it was like, I don't get it. And then they just sit there and sort of repeat it back to me a second time, hoping that, well, if I say it slower, maybe this time you'll get it. And so having had that experience, having known that I was a struggling student in myself, I feel like that actually made me a better instructor. I got to a point where when I started instructing for the university I graduated from, my favorite thing was that I became known as the guy who could help those that did struggle.
Oh, yes.
And so if somebody had a handful of instructors and they were still stuck in the same place, they'd come to me and they'd go, okay, fix it. And the first thing we would do is discuss, like, okay, what's going on? Where do you think you're at? What have been the struggles? Let's talk about why your CFI has failed you, not why you have failed.
Awesome.
And it was usually a really good kind of breakthrough thing. So in your case, having had some personal struggles to try to get to where you are, I think that that makes you a potentially more understanding and better flight instructor in the long run. So I hope, maybe somewhere down the line it becomes something that you want to do.
Yeah, it's definitely in the realm of possibility now, which is feels wild to me to even say that. But I looked at George the other day. I said, "Well, this is now, as we talked earlier, this is now an addiction, and I am a music and yoga educator and writer, so not made of money. So the only way I'm going to keep flying is if I become a flight instructor. So let's do that." Yeah, I had a teacher in undergrad, Pete Hadcock, who was in the Boston Symphony Orchestra for 25 years, and also in the Boston Pops as well. And he was a real get it done kind of musician. He was kind of like what you were describing. He had to figure everything out the hard way. He was in a quartet at Eastman back when he was an undergrad with Larry Combs, who was the principal clarinetist of Chicago Symphony. And he used to joke, "Oh, we used to let Larry be in our little quartet, But Larry Combs is a much more of a natural clarinetist. He could sort of just play, right? I have had lessons with him. He's a great instructor. But Pete, if I couldn't figure something out, like some really complicated passage, like Ravel or something, that's just a finger twister, and you just like, how am I even supposed to play this thing? He'd say, "Well, try it this way." Oh, it didn't work. "Well, maybe try that." Oh, that didn't work. "Well, maybe try practicing it this way." "Well, maybe try that way." He could, on the cuff, come up with 10, 15, 20 different ways to practice something. And it wasn't just that he did that, it was that he taught me how to figure things out. Like, if you have a problem, look at it all around the circle and break it down into all these different ways. And I just find that's true across all disciplines. That gives me hope that my struggles have not been in vain.
No, never, never. And that's a it's a great segue into, the yoga and the classical musician side of this. So you've been an educator in various forms for a really long time in different industries. And now that you've broken into the aviation industry too, you can kind of see the comparisons of what your experience has been with George versus maybe some of the experiences you've either had learning as a musician or in yoga or as a educator yourself. What are some of the sort of similarities and what kinds of things can you take from one industry and sort of interchange it in either direction, that might be useful to people?
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot lately now that I'm able to zoom out a little bit and sort of see things. I think when you're in, primary training, it's just so hyper focused on remember to use the freaking rudders, woman. Your feet are part of this equation. But I have been trying to learn more about sort of the industry as a whole, and particularly flight instruction. I mean, as you know, I think why I'm on the podcast is because I listen to your podcast because
Yay.
I just like soak it all up. So, things I'm saying, if I make mistakes, people who are listening, who are like industry people who really know this stuff, I am new, I am learning. So if there's things I get wrong, just email me, let me know. I want to hear about it. Because I don't know what I don't know at this point.
Pilots
But
are gentle.
what's that?
Said pilots are gentle. It'll be all right.
Well, I mean, that's fine, but I would like to have, ongoing conversations about this because it is relatively new to me. But what I have seen thus far, when I found AeroVenture, which is the school that I'm at, I told them, you are not getting rid of me. I am here because I know that what I have here is rare. And from what I've heard from other people, this is not how it goes other places, right? I have flight instructors who are here, they're in it to win it, they will stick with me for the long haul. No one's leaving tomorrow or the next day. And, it can really build relationships that have meaning and value here. What I've sort of seen, I think that they're. There can always be a push. I've seen this in yoga, so I can give this analogy. There can be this push of like, we want more. I hear this all the time. We want more people to fly. And there's a huge demand now for pilots. There's a huge demand in flight schools. And then we have this corresponding, I guess there's been a huge spike in the failure rate of first-time check rides, right? I mean, it's kind of scary numbers. And for me as an educator, now I've been teaching since I was in seventh grade and I'm now 50 plus. So do the math, long time. Seen this for sure in yoga, which I can talk about. There is a significant challenge that happens when there's a push to make something not necessarily more accessible, but there's always a push. We want everyone to have this experience. We want more people to fly. We want more people to do yoga. What can happen is what happened in the yoga industry. So use this, I wouldn't even say as a cautionary tale, because I think it's happening in, from what I can tell, in the aviation industry, is there's a big push. Yoga came, very potted history. Yoga came to the US around the time of the hippies, right? Around the time of Woodstock. That's when it really kind of exploded into cultural consciousness. People were doing it as a way of sort of transcending their mind and getting into these sort of higher perspectives of themselves and the universe. And then the postural boom happened in the 80s, where everyone was like, think of 80s aerobics with the headbands and all that. Then the postural boom started. Everyone wanted to get that like yoga body, and the yoga became very identified with the body. And the classical yogis like me were like, that's part of it, but it's mostly so that you can be comfortable, so you can be like a useful person and feel good and live a long life, not so that you can stand on your head. It's to stand on your own 2 feet. But all of these booms then happened, and they said, well, we got to step in and regulate that. We better come up with some standards, blah, blah, blah. So I won't get into the whole yoga the whole yoga accreditation morass, I won't go there, but there is a prevailing belief right now that the 200-hour training in yoga is sort of the standard. And that once you get trained at that 200-hour level, you can call yourself a blah, blah, blah yoga teacher and get hired at a health club and teach yoga. So, how long is 200 hours? It's like a month or so of training. Is anyone really ready to teach someone after a month of training? And what happens then is that the bar gets lowered because now that bar to entry has been lowered. And I don't believe it's this way, and I've never belonged to the Yoga Alliance, I'll call them out, who has this sort of 200-hour accreditation. Never belonged to them because I think it's an absolute travesty. They do great work on the side of advocating for legal issues for yoga teachers, but the whole accreditation and registration, it's a debacle. So 200 hours of training, then people get 200 hours. They say, "Oh, I'm a yoga teacher now. Got it." Then they go teach in a health club, and someone who just had a heart attack, 61 years old, out of shape, goes and takes hot yoga, where they're going to do 108 sun salutations, which is a thing where you just flow and flow and flow through poses over and over without resting. That teacher has 200 hours of training, doesn't know to look as this person is walking through the door, going, "This is not going to be the right class for that gentleman." That gentleman takes that yoga class, leaves there feeling completely frazzled, and they go, "Yoga doesn't work for me. That's it. Yoga, I tried that once. It's not for me." And then they're gone. So then what happens? That person is out there saying, "Yoga doesn't work. I tried it once." They tell other people. And then the whole cultural consciousness sort of changes. They think yoga is moving the body. It's what you look like. It's wearing a leotard or whatever. People don't wear leotards anymore. You know what I mean? But it's sort of this gradual, I don't want to say dumbing down, but I'll say it. It's a dumbing down and a devaluing of the whole wisdom tradition is what happens because the bar has been lowered. And when I look sometimes at aviation, I really started to look around. I went like, "Oh my God, the same thing seems to be happening in aviation." And that's not good. I hear this call now, "Oh, why are so many students failing?" And I'm like, "Why are you accepting so many students?" So I'll give my last little thing that I want to hear your thoughts. For me as an educator for years, I wanted to make yoga more accessible and make the clarinet more accessible to more people. I pushed for that. I advocated for it. I started yoga therapy programs at music schools and ran whole things and I trained other teachers and I did that and I did that and I did that. And then one day I stopped and I was like, "There is no way that I can keep the quality of these teachers to the standard it needs to be if they're going to put their hands on children with special needs." Because the prevailing wisdom of the community is you get that 200 hours or you get that piece of paper and now you're good. And these teachers are not practicing themselves every day. They're not holding themselves accountable for their own meditation, their own hatha yoga, their own investigating their own mind. They have the piece of paper, so they think they're good. They hardly ever practice, they hardly ever do recurrent training, and they're going into these classrooms full of children with special needs, teaching them quote unquote yoga. I'm like, "What are you? You're not actually even a yogi," but they have the piece of paper. So they want to argue with me and tell me that they are. So I see sort of the same thing happening in flight instruction. So what I did with myself and my own thing is I had to reel myself back and I said, "I have to be more clear when people come to my studio." Well, I stopped doing all those programs I was doing. I just shut it all down. I left it all. Took care of my students for sure, but stopped trying to expand. More is better. More is not better. Better quality is better. So I set a goal to myself. My goal as an educator is to help my students to be themselves. That's it. If they want to be a great yogi, fabulous. I'll take you as far as my, energy can support you. If they want to be a clarinetist, I can teach that to you. If in that process of discovery you decide, "Oh my gosh, I actually think I want to go off and be something else, unrelated, an engineer," I'll be like, "Great, I know an engineer I can connect you with. Like, that's my job." And I started to be very clear with students when they entered into my studio, "You're expected to practice, and here's how much or how little." Of course, not to a crazy level, right? But I do expect you to practice in both yoga and music. I expect you to show up prepared with all of your materials. Set the bar really high and keep it high. And as students start sinking under it, remind them that they're sinking under it and push them to do better. And if they don't, let them go. Most of the times they self-selected out of that, right? Suddenly they're like, oh, I've got volleyball and I've got this and I've got that. Say, great, go do that stuff. Because if you're not going to show up here 100%, there is no point to you being here. And I have fewer students now, and I adjusted that by charging more money per student. I just said, hey, educator of 30 plus years, blah, blah, blah. I charge more money. I have fewer students, but they're going much farther and much deeper into the material. And it's much richer because I'm not just trying to push more through. My more now is better quality rather than more volume. And I see the same thing in flight instruction happening. Why do we need more and more and more and more? Is that, can we really keep the standard that high? I'm kind of asking you that question because I don't know. I'm too new, but I
You
try.
know, that's a really great question, and it's a even better observation. I mean, there's a lot of
There
pieces
is a
to this
lot. Yeah.
conversation.
Yeah.
One of those pieces, and I'm going to preface anything I say by saying, like, I am was is the classification of what somebody might consider a quote unquote transient or I hate to use the word time builder instructor, but ultimately I used flight instruction as a launch pad to other things. I can't deny that.
Yeah.
In the industry, the way it's structured, it's almost a necessity, right?
Yeah.
And that's not the instructor's fault. That's whoever created the system, whether it be, Congress, who literally knows nothing about anything, deciding that they're going to sort of mandate certain rules for an industry they don't understand.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. So I have to, I'm not here to disparage anybody who followed the exact same path that I did.
Yeah.
However, what I'd like to say about myself and advocate for anybody else doing it is because flight instruction is one of the last vestiges of how you can launch your career. You have to sort of be understanding of yourself of what am I going to do with this? Everybody says it's a small world and don't burn a bridge and all of these sort of cliche things. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it is absolutely true in aviation. Everybody knows everybody. And so, if your idea of flight instruction is, well, I'm going to do this until I get the arbitrary 1,000 or 1,500 hours or whatever it is that you want, do it for the right reasons. Understand that, yeah, it's for yourself, but what am I doing? Well, I'm doing this for someone else too. They're giving me their personal safety. They're giving me their psyche, their understanding of themselves and what they want to achieve. And of course, they're giving me their hard-earned money. It is my responsibility as an instructor to take that to heart and make sure that what I'm doing is the right thing. I'm doing the best job that I can for that person during the duration that I'm there. Am I going to leave at some point? Yeah, probably. But there's a difference between leaving and making sure that you have done in your heart of hearts the best job you could, or I'm leaving and I was a seat filler for however long I was here. I passed on something. Some of it was right, some of it wasn't. This person's going to go and have an airplane accident, a year from now, and I'm going to be responsible because I didn't do the right thing. And I think that that's where, in the industry, we sort of conflict with ourselves because we have people that aren't there for the right reasons. They're there because they have to be. And unfortunately, we've gotten to a point where not everybody should be an instructor, but because they have no other options, what else can they do? And you can say, point to them and say, well, you're not doing this right, but at the same time, well, what else are they supposed to do? And there's a couple other avenues out there, but this is kind of the most prolific way to do it. On the other side of the coin, and this is sort of in reference to something that you mentioned, we have, as an industry, we have spent years and millions of dollars welcoming people in, saying, hey, anyone can do this. It's fun, it's great, anyone can do this. And I take a little bit of umbrage with the idea that anyone can do it
I
for a
agree.
couple of reasons. A, you're setting unrealistic expectations for maybe somebody who can't. Because now all of a sudden, if they try and it doesn't work out, well, what's wrong with me? You told me anybody could do it. Now I feel even worse about myself because not only did I not achieve what I wanted, but I'm now considering in my own head, I'm the minority. That guy over there can do it, really? But I can't. You know, and that you've created this tension. And I think that with enough effort, we can help people accomplish their goals, but we also have to be honest with ourselves that, you know, as you mentioned, if they're not going to practice, if they're not going to study, you know, if they're not going to hit certain metrics, it's incumbent upon me to tell that student, hey, maybe this isn't for you. And that's not a bash on you. I'm not trying to insult you. I'm not trying to say you're less than. I'm just saying that, like, sometimes my responsibility as a teacher, especially for something that can be dangerous, is to say, look, I have to tell you no because I care about you. I have to tell you no because I don't want to see something happen to you down the road, whether it's with me or whether you've got three instructors down the road, and maybe that third instructor doesn't care about you as much as I do. Maybe they're the ones that are going to let you go and do something that I knew now isn't for you. And so, you know, like we struggle with that. And then we get to that point where it's like, okay, well, I need more students to pay my own bills. I need more students to get to this place. So we're encouraged in some cases to, like you said, take on more and more and more for our own personal well-being. And we sort of lose track that, yes, your personal well-being is important, but your sort of professional reputation, the safety of who you're working with, the values that they're developing are at stake in this too. And how do you balance that? You know, it's kind of an interesting way of doing things. I mean, again, I was fresh out of college when I became an instructor. And so it's not necessarily right, wrong, or otherwise, but it is a very interesting industry for something so complicated for the newest people teaching the newest people. You know, you don't necessarily always have the 10,000 hour pilot. You know, whether it's they've been an instructor the whole time or they've gone and done other things and said, hey, I've mastered my craft. I'm going to come back and teach. It's, hey, I just got my commercial license. I'm going to go and teach a would-be student. And I've really never seen anything outside of the training environment. I've almost always flown with an instructor. My solo time is 20 hours. I'm going to go teach another student and effectively fly solo with them and hope that nothing bad happens. And it's a wonder that our industry has managed to stay as relatively safe as it has. And I think that's a credit to the training that we have and some of the new instructors that are out there. I think that a lot more often than not, they're doing a really wonderful job, despite whether the industry gives them credit for it or not. But it's backwards. And it's a very difficult thing. You're gonna screw up. I know I had a few students, and this came up in the original story that you and I talked about from your first email. I didn't know how to interact with sort of the way students were afraid of things or hesitations they might have or how, you know, potentially aggressive I may be coming on because I was excited. And to my excitement to someone else was aggressiveness. I had an older lady, and I admire her to this day, although I only ever met her once. And she wanted to go flying and she wanted to be a student and she told me what she was afraid of. And I did exactly kind of what you were referencing where I was like, oh, it'll be fine. We're gonna do it. I'll show you this thing. And we went up and she was afraid and I didn't catch on. I was a, you know, maybe 20 something pilot and I
You're like,
never saw her
this
again.
is awesome.
Yeah, and it pains me to this day because I hope she went out and found another instructor. I hope I didn't kill that dream in that moment without even knowing what I was doing. You know, I hate to say you got to crack a few eggs, but unfortunately I had to learn that. And in that reflection I went, I'm never going to do that again, you know. And I it did make me better, but it is a shame that it came at the expense of somebody else. And luckily for me, that was the worst that happened. You know, nobody got hurt. Nothing bad happened from a physical standpoint. It just sort of maybe changed someone's sort of mental state. And that, you know, is it
Was
can be just as
uncomfortable.
damaging. So, yeah, it's I don't know if that actually answers your question, but it's sort of an acceptance of yes, there is an issue.
Right.
The answer is several pronged, coming from many different directions, and how we tie that up is extremely difficult.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to solve that problem today.
Right? Right?
Yes, key to the yoga music educator. That's it. That took one podcast. We got it figured out.
That's
But
right.
obviously, there are huge regulatory issues in the way the industry is set up. There could be some paradigm shifts there. But I just think there's just no shortcuts in life, though, right? Like, if you want to be a quality educator, quality instructor, it takes time and it takes discipline. So whether you're doing it for the relatively short term or you're a career CFI, time and discipline, and you can up that level of time by studying more about teaching. And for me, the best way to learn is to study with master teachers. So I don't know if there's a new CFI out there at all, but like I initially got trained in yoga for the special child. Sorry, they just changed their name, Yoga for All Abilities, many, many years ago. And I thought, this is a brilliant teacher. Sonia Sumar, the founder, she's brilliant teacher. So I took, all of her trainings, quote unquote, got all the certificates or whatever, but I kept going back to her basic 1 week training course over and over and over again. And people would always be like, why have you taken that like 12 times? You've been doing this for like a decade now. You have your own department, you do all of your continuing ed, but you keep taking that one over and over. I'm like, it's not to get the material again, it's to watch her teaching the other people in the class again, because people come up against their own resistance or their own ideas about how it should be done, or there's a lot that goes into unpacking things when you're in a room with people, for over a week doing this type of training. So I would watch how she would handle people's mental resistance, emotional resistance, physical resistance, and just how creative she was with each different group about getting people to sort of come along with her very deep and rich understanding of the wisdom tradition. And I learned so much from that. So if you have teachers that you like or flight instructors that you like, don't just do the minimum, right? Like, sit in the back seat, fly around with them again, sit in on a ground session. Like, there's ways that you can learn more and be more effective without just needing to do, more laps in the pattern with a new student. But I don't know. I can say one more thing about it. It's a more philosophical thing, but there can be a tendency I've noticed for humans, myself included, we want to blame the government or the school, or I used to work like at a college, so it's always the administration, is doing this and doing that, like just let teachers complain, and we will. And there's a very real beefs like that we're having with, like you were saying, like with the FAA or senators making up their minds about this when they don't know anything about it. All very true and real. However, one of the most wise and effective leaders we ever had is Gandhi, and he said that famous thing, right? Be the change you wish to see in the world. Something extremely powerful happens when every single person stops complaining about things they can't control and dials up the volume on the things they can control, because it sets a tone and energy and an expectation and a like a what am I trying? A boundary, a limitation, and a rule for this is the way things are done, and the standard is up here, and it never ever slips. And that has so much power that I think people don't realize how much power they actually have when they don't just go, oh, well, we can't because it's just the way it is. Say, yes, that is the way it is, but here's how I am conducting myself. That moves mountains, and that actually leads to a lot more change than people realize, because then you attract the people who are interested in doing that, you empower them to do it more, and it grows and it grows and it grows until eventually then that force can push back against like the larger forces, like Gandhi did in India with the Brits. Then you have that sort of mass momentum of people taking personal responsibility that can really push back, and that's usually then when the larger governments and things shift even a little bit, but it has to start there with each person embodying it. I think so often people kind of use it as an excuse, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I can't because it's just you, because this, because that. I'm like, I just again hear my teacher saying, like, stop complaining about what other people are doing. What are you doing? Or as my dad would say, rise above it. He would just say, rise
That's good
above it.
advice.
Rise above, because I'd be, nee, 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 listen to me, nee, nee. He'd be like, rise above it. I'm like, oh yeah, right. So
So I feel like I could have two or three more podcasts with you, because I have
he
so
would
many
love to
questions,
talk.
and
He
there's so
would
many
love to
things
talk.
that we have prepped in this discussion that we could go another handful of hours. But at the risk of taking too much of your time, I've got sort of one last question slash topic item, and we referenced this in our previous conversation as well, and that's, I told you a story about how when I first kind of went into the airlines, and I did it for a short period of time, it was probably, one of the highest points of my life of just mass anxiety. Some of it was just the idea that, this is professional training, and professional training, it can either be great and it follows you forever, or, you can not do well, and okay, well, where's my next job going to be if this doesn't work out? Thankfully for me, it did. But then that sort of perpetuated into, oh my God, this airplane's really big. There's 75 people behind me. That's a lot of pressure. I got to do this right. If it doesn't go right, people get hurt and bad things happen. I started a search for any possible way to sort of calm myself, calm the sort of inner anxiety of, whether it's imposter syndrome or just stress or, any of those types of things. And one of the things that I did find was I got into a little bit of meditation. It's not probably anything like what you've done, but it has helped. And I actually need to find a way to kind of do it on a more regular basis. Sometimes for me, it's kind of that rip cord of, okay, I'm starting to feel a little bit anxious. I guess I need to do it. And sort of like we talked about previously, by that point, it's almost too late. I haven't built up that threshold to keep things down. I think that, pilots may not always be as open to things like that as some other aspects of the general public. And it did work for me. What kinds of things could you tell somebody who maybe has those same kinds of anxious feelings or looking to overcome stress? How does that world help with those kinds of things, and what could a pilot take away from it?
Well, I can address that twofold. One is just from my own experience, and then one sort of more generally, which is geared towards if a pilot came to me said, "Hey, I'm looking for some resources. What would you tell me?" So, from my own viewpoint, well, I mean, I've learned, and I do consider myself a budding aviator. You know, being an aviator is definitely a way of life. It's just sort of a way that. I mean, you have to conduct yourself, you have to get enough sleep and, you know, eat quality food and be sharp mentally. That can take some effort. And one of the first things I learned in flight training was the I'm safe checklist, illness, medication, sleep, all that. And I have to say that because I have a long-standing morning, what we call sadhana, which is just a fancy word for practice. I have a morning practice I do every single morning. I have a short one for it's like, oh, I have 15 minutes and the puppy is crying, so I'm going to do this. And then I have a long one that can take like 2 hours plus sometimes. I love doing that one, but I don't always have that time. But because I've had that consistently for, I had a consistent practice for about 15 years, and then it's been 15 years plus that I've done this specific morning practice within the tradition I'm with now. So it's a long time of this set routine. And what this set routine has done for me is that when I go into that state of doing my practice, I cannot hide from myself. So, folks out there, can you relate? Have you ever, like, you feel like you're maybe getting a cold, but you're like, oh, it's fine. I'll go through my day, I'll be fine. And then by noon, you're like, I'm not fine. I'm not okay. I should have listened to that one. Or you maybe feel like you're having some emotions, a loved one has died or something, and you're not feeling great mentally, but you're like, it's fine. I'm gonna push through. I'm gonna go to work. And then you find yourself in the bathroom, like about to have a meltdown because you didn't realize how much stress that you know, loss of a loved one was causing you. For me, when I do my morning practice, it is my opportunity to see myself both as a human having that experience and just to let myself feel what I'm feeling and just sort of notice, actually notice it without distracting myself, but also to go to a much higher perspective and look at everything from sort of like a bird's eye view, if you will, a bit of aviation adjacent imagery there, but right, to really see things from a bird's eye perspective. How is my body? Not just how I want it to be, but how is it actually doing? Because I do the same breathing, the same meditation, and the same physical movements, it's like having the ultimate checklist. How is my mind? How is my breathing? How is my body? Is that back pain really not as bad as I thought? Or is it actually like, I think I need to ground myself and go to the doctor? Because it's so easy to distract ourselves away from how we're actually doing and just use our mind to like push through when we actually shouldn't be. So for me, it's given me just that great sort of checklist. Like, how am I? So that's my advocating for morning practice, as well as giving me tons of abundant energy and just feeling really good and peaceful, and it's just awesome. I love it. But if someone was coming to me and they were like, I would love to get into something like that, but I don't know what, I would say it's the same advice I always give, the same advice my husband gives, who just retired from many, many years as an educator in the public school, as a history teacher, two kids with behavioral issues. But he's a big workout and yoga and Qigong person as well. He says the same thing. Find something you like and stick with it. So it might be jogging, it might be running, it might be jumping rope, it might be walking in the woods, it might be writing 3 pages longhand every morning, which is from Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way. It might be, finding a meditation technique that you like. You might like that. It might be Tai Chi, it might be Kung Fu, it might be Taekwondo. Looking for any of these, very often they're traditional, but practices that bring the body and the mind together in a way so that you can be fully present with yourself, but also engaged in the activity you're doing. For me, yeah, it's yoga because it's got like chanting and breathing and moving. And guess what? The music teacher loves chanting and breathing and moving. Like, that's what works for me. But for you, John, it might be something else. Or someone else out there listening, they might be like, oh, yeah, I took Taekwondo when I was 15 and I freaking loved it. Well, why can't you do it when you're 50? It's the same thing of getting that body mind discipline and really getting to know your instrument of the body and the instrument of the mind. And all of those paths, if you find one that you like and you stick with it, they all lead to the same place. The Zen masters that I train with, the great musicians that I train with, the yogis that I train with, they all get to the same realization. Like, it's all one energy. We're all playing with it. We're all just experiencing the universe through these bodies, and we're all sort of connected in that exploration. We have our unique perspectives. But it's all kind of one unified field, just kind of manifesting in and out of existence. That went way metaphysical. But my point is that each personality is going to have something that they love. It might be painting watercolors. Doesn't matter. You're looking for something that sort of you find enjoyment with that connects your body and your mind in some sort of discipline or art. And you find a teacher that you like and you just do it every day, a little bit, 10, 15 minutes. And see what happens from there.
That's good advice.
You don't have to sit on a meditation cushion like Gita does, because it might not be your jam. You know what I mean? You might be like, no, I love to, I don't want to say CrossFit, but I will. Some people are like CrossFit people. I think they can be a little extreme, but.
Well, I don't think I can come up with anything more profound than that, and I'm not even gonna try. So I think that's a fantastic way to end the podcast. And of course, Gita, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you for reaching out initially. And all of this comes from the idea that we try to put out the contact us. You never know what might come from it. I think that everybody has a perspective to add, whether you're an instructor, a student, an instructor in another sort of community or talent base. I think that the telling of the stories is the most important part. So thank you so much for joining.
It is beyond my pleasure. I hope some of this was useful or at least vaguely interesting. If anyone ever wants to reach out, feel free. My contact info is just my name, Gita Brown, Gita Brown at gmail.com. anyone has questions or wants to correct me on anything I've gotten wrong, I love to learn. So reach out anytime.
Is that how somebody would contact you to be a student of yours if they wanted to?
Correct. Yep. And you
Okay.
can go to my website, which is just my name too, gitabrown.com. It's all pretty easy to find. If you Google me, there's not too many Gita Browns. So I'm
Perfect.
findable.
Well, thanks again for joining.
My pleasure.